this month's episode of the History Explorer podcast series, we'll be speaking with Catherine Ott, a curator here at the National Museum of American History. 30 years ago this summer marks the discovery of HIV and AIDS. While not marking the first cases of the illness, this anniversary marks the point when the medical community and society took notice. Catherine will be discussing the medical advancements that led to the discovery of the disease and some of the consequences that took place afterwards.
My name's Catherine Ott. I'm a curator here at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History in the Division of Medicine and Science.
So I understand that there is an exhibit case that's going on display here at the museum, a timely exhibit case, and can you explain what that significance is?
Yeah. 30 years ago, this summer, the first cases of HIV and AIDS were reported or came to light. Even though there had already been cases of it, no one knew about it in a way that scientists and epidemiologists were able to see patterns and put the pieces together. So one of the things we like to do at the museum is put historical events in context, because especially really significant events like the first reports about HIV and AIDS. So we're doing a showcase, we're doing a display at the Archive Center, we have an AIDS quilt panel we're going to put out on display, and I'm going to write blogs. Some of the people on the exhibit team are going to write blogs also throughout the year.
How does AIDS affect the body, and if you could just briefly explain the disease?
Yeah, what it is and what it does. Okay. Well, so you can be infected with the HIV, which is a virus, for years and not know it unless you get a blood test. So say you're infected with it. You've been exposed to the virus. It's inside your body. After a while, as your immune system gets weaker, you get sick with diseases that you could otherwise be able to fight off. And there are certain diseases that tip off doctors that you're infected with this particular virus. There are specific cancers, kinds of pneumonia, tuberculosis. HIV is short for human immunodeficiency virus. An infection is different from having AIDS. AIDS is short for acquired immune deficiency syndrome, which is what happens after years of being infected when you get really sick. HIV's a virus, and infection with it messes up your immune system. So you get HIV by getting the virus into your body, and you can mostly through having sex in certain ways or through blood exchange, using a contaminated needle to inject yourself. Sometimes mothers can pass the virus to their babies. You can get it through blood transfusion, although most people don't get it that way anymore. 30 years ago, epidemiologists tended to define risk for HIV by identity of the person, by group identities, gay men mostly. And that was not really true. It was not because a person was gay that they got sick. So then they described it as risk behaviors. Certain things a person did put them at risk, which is more accurate, but still not really precise enough. And it still kind of blames the victim. Then public health workers figured out that the issue is actually exposure to the virus. And now they talk about exposure. So you have your immune system. Your immune system is the part of your body that counters sickness and infection. It expels intruders in your body like germs. And for viruses like the flu or polio, hepatitis, your immune system has macrophages, which eat the intruder with their enzymes, and they pass the processed stuff they eat to white blood cells, which are called lymphocytes. And the lymphocytes take it away. And there are two kinds of white blood cells, T and B, and the T white blood cells, or T lymphocytes also called, are the ones that we're interested in with HIV. And the T lymphocytes are the germ killers of the immune system. The T cells with CD4 proteins on their surface are the ones that HIV likes the most and attaches itself to, and that's where the problem begins. When HIV attaches to the T cell, it really messes it up, and then the T cell can't do what it's supposed to do, which means that eventually the whole immune system goes out of whack and you can't deal with stuff coming into your body, so you get sick. And in the history of HIV and figuring out all of this stuff, there's so many discoveries that had to come before it in order for us to be able, for scientists and researchers and public health workers, to be able to figure out what was going on. So viruses are so tiny, they couldn't even see them before the invention of the electron microscope in the 1940s. Today, and in the 1980s, there are several ways you can figure out if there's HIV in your body. You can look for it, which is really hard. You can look for characteristic damage that the virus causes. You can remove the try to remove the virus and grow it somewhere else, and that's really hard to do with HIV. You can detect its presence indirectly through finding specific proteins that it leaves behind, and with a process called PCR, which takes a little bit of DNA and makes thousands of copies of it. So there are different ways to test for it. It took them three years to figure out. First, they had to discover what was causing the disease. Then they found the virus, and then it took them another year to come up with a test for it. So the first cases, 30 years ago. One thing to remember is that in history, things never really happen out of the blue or unconnected to what else is happening. One of the primary rules of history is that everything has a context, a surrounding. Everything is part of lots of other things we already know. And it's the same with biology, medicine, politics, society. It's all bonded together in a close relationship, and one affects the other. So 30 years ago, Los Angeles and New York, there are young men who are getting sick with stuff that's unusual. Also, we know now, we didn't know then, but we know now that there were already cases in the 1970s, especially in Africa, but no one really noticed. And there were women who were sick with this too, but no one really noticed. The Centers for Disease Control, nicknamed the CDC, so the CDC was tipped off that something was going on, because suddenly in the spring of 1981, they got a lot of requests for a drug that nobody ever hardly asked for, called pentamidine. And in fact, this drug was so rare that the CDC was the only place that had it in the country. That's why they knew. And it wasn't even that many more requests. It was like 15. But that was so unusual, they were really curious what was happening. And this drug was primarily used to treat a special kind of pneumonia. And I think I said already, there were thousands of people infected before the first cases were even recognized in this country, and many thousands more became infected before the cause and the means of transmission were understood. So that's what happens. The epidemiologists, who are the people who study where and why disease happens, got busy right away to try to figure out why New York, why Los Angeles. The first cases they saw these disease, there was a kind of cancer and a kind of pneumonia that usually you only get if you have an immune system that's been knocked out, or if you're a really old guy, you would get the kind of cancer. So it was really crazy that these young guys were getting these illnesses, and the only thing they had in common, besides they both lived in these two cities, was that they were all gay men. So that's what got the ball rolling.
So that was the medical community's initial response. What was the initial public response to this disease compared to maybe other epidemics that have happened in the past in America?
There were several layers or several levels of response. Gay men in large cities in the U.S. were already suspicious that something was happening because a lot of their friends were dying and getting sick. And this is in the late 1970s, before the first reports, the first patterns started to emerge. So people knew things were happening. And then when it became public, there were a couple of newspaper reports, and then slowly word starts to get out that there's this new mysterious illness that's affecting, they thought it was mostly gay men. Then some women, heterosexual women, are identified as having the disease. Then injection drug users are identified, Haitian immigrants, a whole lot of other groups start to emerge. And because the first groups were politically disliked or culturally disliked, gay men, injection drug users, politically it became a hot potato. It was a flashpoint. A lot of politicians, a lot of fearful people started scapegoating, which has happened in pretty much every epidemic in history. When a new disease entity occurs, those with the fewest resources or who have the least power are the ones who are blamed. So, and when a new disease comes, people try to figure out what's happening. And they get scared, and they blame whole groups of people for bringing it, or as the cause of it. In past epidemics, foreigners were blamed. The French blamed the British. The British blamed the French for syphilis with tuberculosis. In the 19th and early 20th century, people blamed poor immigrants from Eastern Europe. In the South with tuberculosis, African-American maids and housekeepers were blamed for bringing the disease into white people's houses. Jewish people were blamed for the bubonic plague. In New Orleans, yellow fever was blamed on the Italians. With HIV, gay men were picked out and scapegoated. Most of the first cases reported were in gay men, although other people had it. But in the 1980s, many people disliked gay men, and this made them an easy target for abuse, for hatred, for blame.
What were some of the advances in medicine that allowed for the actual discovery of AIDS and HIV?
Yeah, which is one of the really, I mean, it's why history and learning history is so interesting, because if HIV had emerged even like 15 years earlier, I think the story would have been really different. Far more people. I mean, there were thousands who died in the 80s anyway, but far more people would have been affected and would have died because they didn't have the tools even 15 years earlier to understand this kind of disease. So they needed, there's a whole long history of tiny little discoveries made by people who are scientists, epidemiologists, who are researchers, who are slowly, and they didn't know, I mean, you don't look forward and think, oh, this piece of the puzzle will someday solve this other disease. You can't see into the future, but so they're just working on problems that come up in their lifetime. There's virology, which until the mid-20th century was not really a very cohesive, coherent field of study. Viruses existed. They knew about viruses, Pasteur. So they knew these tiny little things smaller than bacteria existed, but nobody could see them. They had to guess indirectly that they existed by seeing their effect. They would pass liquids through filters, and then whatever didn't go through, or whatever went through the filter was called a filterable virus, is what they were first called, because it was so small, it could pass through the tightest filters. Then the electron microscope in 1940, 42, where they could actually see stuff like polio. They had to figure out how to grow quantities of viruses in a lab setting so they could test it to see what it did, what it was, what could you be used to treat it. And those were techniques that were worked out slowly over time. What do you grow something in? What does it like to eat? In the late 1950s, McFarlane Burnett laid the groundwork for understanding T cells, which are so crucial to understanding HIV. And he wrote about and described the cellular nature of the immune system. This is what Robert Gallo did, finding a retrovirus and reverse transcriptase that was like 1970. Reverse transcriptase was discovered by two guys, David Baltimore and Howard Temin. Was like a huge breakthrough. They got the Nobel Prize. And Robert Gallo used the presence of reverse transcriptase to find the first retrovirus in 1978-79. So there's all this knowledge accumulating. The kind of antibody test that was used once they found the virus, called the ELISA test, which comes in the late 1950s, I think, early 60s. So, I said a minute ago, if it had appeared earlier, nobody would have been able to deal with it. It actually did appear earlier, and nobody noticed, because all of this knowledge had not accumulated. They found cases retrospectively back to like 1959 that they believe now were HIV and AIDS.
This story really shows how connected history is to other subjects, especially in science. You have all this compounded knowledge and compounded events that lead to scientific breakthroughs, such as being able to actually discover what is going on with these things.
That at any one time, there's a lot of knowledge out there, but how do you know which knowledge matters, which is relevant to the problem you're trying to solve? And the accumulation of these tiny bits of problem solving is what science is. It's the research process that's so important, because you never know what application is going to come of your work. You think you're solving one problem, but you end up contributing to the solution to something else.
What has changed in medicine as a result of the HIV AIDS epidemic?
The work that's been in science and also in public policy, in social and cultural change that's come out of the HIV and AIDS epidemic, it's affected, like, pick a topic almost, and you can find an effect. In cultural terms, gay people are much more visible and accepted. It was kind of inevitable that if you're sick and dying, and AIDS, when you die of AIDS or dying with AIDS, you look recognizably ill, and you can't hide that. So in some ways people were forced to come out of the closet and to be known as being gay. Unfortunately, a lot of times young men came out to their families at the same time they had to tell them they were dying. Benefit for all of us is that gay people are out of the closet in ways they never were. Their lives and contributions culturally are much more known, are more integrated into American life. So socially, that's been a major shift. We talk about safe sex more than before. Certainly, sex education is a part of most school curriculums. Scientifically, appreciation of cell surface markers in orchestrating the immune system has hugely advanced. The importance of public health is much better understood. Advances in lab techniques and knowledge related to studying the immune system have resulted. FDA was affected in drug testing and being forced to include, because the people getting sick were desperate for treatment and for knowledge and for research to take place and for government funding to be put toward finding the cause and treatment. So they forced the FDA ACT UP was very instrumental. And actually, they're the ones, when it comes down to it, who forced the ADA to change the way they perform clinical trials to include patient populations in formulating drug treatment clinical trials, and to allow really sick people to get drugs that weren't fully tested, but they were next to death. Why not let them have drugs that may in some way have a chance of helping them? We're much more aware also socially and in public health and epidemiology of the critical role that poverty plays in disease and sickness. And it presents important problems just because a person is poor. For example, with HIV, most of the women who are HIV positive, they're not sick, but they have the virus, they've been infected, are poor women and women of color who generally don't have health insurance or access to health care. Mm-hmm. So by the time they go see a doctor, it's almost too late. So, and HIV has really shone a light on how poverty and marginality affect disease and sickness. The art as well, which right. I do history of science and medicine, but I do appreciate art. There have been so many, because art often comes out of great pain, and certainly HIV and AIDS have been instigators. And even talking about HIV and AIDS as a scholar, you kind of distance yourself from the anguish and struggle and pain that it brings in people's lives. And art is a way to get a really strong sense of it actually, what's actually happening. There film, theater, painting, poetry, performance art, the production of all of these areas of art has been hugely affected.
I'd like to thank Catherine Ott for taking the time to speak with us. For the History Explorer podcast series, this is Matt Ringelstetter. Join us again next time as we take another look behind the scenes here at the National Museum of American History, funding provided by the Verizon Foundation.